Hello and welcome to the Loopcast. Today I'm very, very happy to have Neda Bakos on the line, and we are going to talk about the recent documentary Manhunt. And I also have to make another note that Manhunt recently won an Emmy, so we are very happy about that and congratulate the team who produced this fantastic documentary. I highly recommend for our listeners to watch it. And Neda was an ex-CIA analyst with the Counterterrorism Center, or should I say division. And we are going to talk about a couple of things. So welcome to the show, Neda.
Thank you.
Why don't we start with just a general overview of your time and experience as a CIA analyst. Why don't we describe what it's like piecing together a story and looking at the story from Al-Qaeda and Al-Zarqawi that you worked with? Worked on, should I say.
Yeah. It would be interesting if I would have worked with him.
Yeah, exactly. The choice of words was a little bit wrong there. Sorry.
So, it's not unlike what an investigative journalist would do when you're piecing together an intelligence picture. You're looking at, disparate bits of information, and you're trying to form them to make a puzzle. So, from our perspective at the agency, we were looking at it, from signal intelligence to human intelligence to technical collection, foreign intel services, across the board. We were gathering this information from a variety of different sources. And any one of those pieces of information in and of itself may look innocuous or not representative of what we're trying to find. But when you add it to the larger puzzle, that's when you can see if it's going to fit. So it's hard to, sift through the chaff to find your actual information that you need to piece together.
And how long, say if you have one specific person that you're looking at or a specific act that happened, whether it's an act of terrorism, does it tend to be a general amount of time that things sort of come together, or is it really, really dependent on the whole set of circumstances? I would figure it's probably a set of circumstances, but describe that to us.
So it does largely depend on the set of circumstances. From a predictive standpoint, if you are looking at trying to gauge when or if an attack is going to happen, that is really difficult, and you're going about looking at the data in a very different way. Because if you have a piece of intelligence that said that there will be an attack, but you don't know the timing and location, your focus is going to be strictly on those two pieces. When you're trying to look at an overall picture and you're not, this is typical of intelligence gathering when you don't know what you have in front of you, you're letting the information tell you what the picture is going to be. And that's the objective challenge for intelligence analysis. And that's what the agency tries to drill into their analysts, to always let the information lead you rather than you lead the information. So your objectivity is clear.
Okay, very interesting. And then on that topic, say, how many people tend to be, if you're going to be focused on one figure, is it one person that's solely dedicated to that figure, or do you have a team working on that specific figure?
So there's always geographic. When I was in, we were focused on geographic areas. It wasn't specifically on one person. It happened that Zarqawi was the head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which obviously he didn't start out that way. He started out as his own disparate network that we were following. So, it depends on how you slice and dice the data of where we are and the problem set that you're looking at. There's analysts that look at, one specific country. So it depends on the kind of analyst. And the Counterterrorism Center at the time, it just depended on your account, is what we called it.
And going to Al-Zarqawi, we know he was Jordanian-born, of course, and he kind of, I guess you could say, fashioned himself into almost a nationless freelance terrorist. I guess that he's been described that way. Would you describe him that way, or do you have a more specific way of describing him?
I think that's probably a decent description. He, unlike many of bin Laden's followers, because he wasn't an adherent until much later, until after we had invaded Iraq. He was interested in focusing on the region, specifically on Jordan and the government of Jordan. So he was his own freelancer. He I think helped build the model for what franchising looked like later for Al Qaeda.
Okay, interesting. I know I found that there are references of as his popularity, that wouldn't be the right word, but as his name grew, Bin Laden was a little bit wondering who this person was and sort of reached out to him, it seems like, a number of times to get him to join forces with Al-Qaeda, and Zarqawi seemed to not be very receptive of that until much later on, from what I've read. Could you give us some thoughts on that?
Well, Bin Laden knew who he was. Zarqawi had his own camp in Herat, Afghanistan, located next to Al-Qaeda's main camp in the late 90s. So he's been around a while. He's known to Al-Qaeda core, but he was a thug. He wasn't somebody they looked at and thought he would be great to groom into a leadership position at the time. So by the time that he started actually making an impact inside of Iraq, it would only make sense from the perspective of Al-Qaeda to jump onto that, onto his brand, and actually exploit that for financing terms. He was getting the money, you know, the funding, the weapons, they needed it certainly at the time, 2003, 2004.
Definitely. I also remember reading that, of course, Zarqawi is known for his highly brutal executions, beheadings, and that I feel like it seems like Bin Laden seemed a bit leery of that, and that there are accounts of different members of Al-Qaeda saying that he was going a little bit extreme, and they weren't sure if they wanted that attached to their name. Is that something you came across as well?
Yeah, the well-known intercepted letter between Al-Qaeda and Zarqawi, I mean, it actually spells out their discontent with his behavior and how he was waging jihad. And he didn't adhere to the same rules and standards that Al-Qaeda core had developed. You know, it's not unlike the Zawahiri guidelines that were recently released. You know, he's also trying to control how the jihad guidelines are interpreted. And clearly they lost control of that when Zarqawi took over as Al-Qaeda in Iraq and pled allegiance to Bin Laden.
Correct. And so looking at 2003, it was a very interesting time. Colin Powell, of course, made a very famous speech to the UN Security Council, basically saying that Iraq was linked with the Ba'athist regime and Bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. And Zarqawi's name came up within this speech, and some say that Colin Powell's speech sort of put Zarqawi into the limelight. Can we discuss this a bit, that he seemed to be sort of a known terrorist in some fields, but in the general public, he was not a very known name. And then all of a sudden, he sort of shot into the media.
Right. Well, I was on the other end of that speech. I was one of the analysts working in the Counterterrorism Center charged with evaluating whether or not Iraq had a relationship with Al-Qaeda in 9/11. And so our judgment and assessment was fed into that speech that Zarqawi was not related to Al-Qaeda and that Al-Qaeda was not related to Iraq. So the premise of going to war was not based upon that, but I don't think that speech in and of itself elevated his reputation. It was the invasion that elevated his reputation and his ability to conduct jihad in the way that he wanted to.
Interesting. And can we actually discuss your time as a senior target analyst when you actually went to Iraq and were involved in this search for Zarqawi?
So I went to Iraq as a regular DI analyst, and then later on when I transferred over to what was the DO and now is the NCS as a targeting officer, you know, I was there early on when it was like the Wild West right after the invasion in 2003, and then throughout. And it from a targeting perspective, you know, your focus is operationalizing the analysis. So you're taking all that big picture and you're doing something about it. So that is your intent from the get-go. When you're a traditional analyst, you're actually writing pieces for the policymaker and you're adding to the larger picture so they can make decisions based upon that intelligence.
Interesting. And as in your time in Iraq, as you say, it was the wild, wild west. How was it as a woman also being in this environment that was quite dangerous, unstable? I mean, I'm sure you had secure locations that you're in, but there are times that you're not in secure locations. Could you describe that a bit for us?
Well, I think initially and early on, the U.S. government writ large was a bit naive about how we were going to be received inside of Iraq. So we took a lot of chances initially. I mean, I was driving around and, you know, I was not in an armored vehicle. I was in, you know, light skin pickup and with, you know, a Glock and maybe an M4 in the back. I mean, it was not, we considered it dangerous, but we were certainly weren't operating at the levels that we started to in 2004 when, you know, we're familiar with IEDs going off all the time and VB IEDs. And it was, as a woman, I would say, really wasn't much different for me, you know, compared to the men that I was working with as civilians. I mean, we all sort of were wide-eyed wondering how we ever got into this and what are we doing here?
I'm sure it's being dropped in another planet, I'm sure. Could you describe your experience during this hunt for Zarqawi? Basically, you're in the middle of an ongoing insurgency. And how would you separate your goals as an intelligence officer and the goals of basically what's happening with this counterinsurgency? So maybe the U.S. military's goals or the coalition's goals versus your goals as a CIA officer.
Inside of Iraq, you mean?
Correct.
Well, you know, because there wasn't effective pre-war planning on what we were going to do post-invasion for rebuilding, we all had a similar goal of trying to stabilize the country, but how we're all going to go about it was still up in the air. And there was, I think, even at that time, a big learning curve for a huge part of the U.S. military and intelligence community on what we should be doing and what, you know, what Iraq's current position is inside of the region and what we can be doing to affect that. So there was just, it was a lot of chaos and conversations and a lot of people at working level really trying to make things more effective because, we, you know, of course, the overarching governance framework was not there.
Okay, I was just going to ask about that. Is like how much interaction between the different, say, military agencies, how much interaction is involved between all of them, or are there conflicts of interest as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that generally arises because it's, you're trying to, you know, figure out who's going to take care of which piece of this, you know, overarching issue. And conflicts are natural, you know, especially when the lines in the sand aren't very clear. And inside of Afghanistan, the agency had primacy for a long time. This is an actual active war zone where the U.S. military had primacy. So it was just all very dependent on geography and where the lines were drawn, and it was somewhat arbitrary at times.
Okay. And then going back to Zarqawi, in Manhunt, you mentioned that even though you've never met him, you became very close with him. And I remember you mentioned that you almost knew him better than actual men in real life. Can you describe what this is like? Because that's very interesting to me. I mean, it's someone that you've spent so many hours and months and years focusing on, and it's this person that is real, but you've actually never met him, but you have this innate knowledge of him.
Well, so I wasn't in love with him.
No, I'm not implying that whatsoever, folks.
No, you know, it's, I tried to not put a face on him, typically, when I was thinking about him, because it just, it was, you know, you try to have boundaries around what you're going to take home and think about later in the day. It's like, you just don't want this constantly on your mind. But, yeah, I mean, there was a point there where it was just, I was just thinking, I don't know the last time I knew, like, an actual love interest in my life as well as I know this person at this point, you know, who I assume he's going to be. But he's, yeah, it just sort of, the whole issue just sort of infects everything you are and do, because you're spending so much time focusing on an ever-losing situation, is what it certainly felt like. So it's just a matter of how you cope with stress, I suppose.
And how do you cope with stress? And like you said, you don't really want to bring it home. I mean, I feel like that's a number one issue for many people in any job that's high stress, highly time consuming.
I'm the wrong person to ask. I would love to be able to give you some kind of healthy response there, but I just kind of compartmentalized it and kept going.
Okay. See, there, that's, everyone has their own ways of dealing with things. Elaborating on the topic of knowing Zarqawi so well, it must have been, I don't know, a surreal experience, basically, to know this person so well, and then ultimately, when he was tracked down in 2006 and killed in an airstrike. I mean, how does that feel? You've spent so much time, once again, as I was saying earlier, you've spent so much time focusing on this person, and then the mission is complete. What was your reaction to this?
I was relieved that that piece of it was over, but at the same time, I questioned. I always thought it would be interesting to sit down and be able to, go through an interview with him just to see what he would say. And then I kept thinking, well, why would I want to do that? This is an irrational human being whose head I'm going to get inside of and find out anything that I even makes sense. I mean, he's justifying killing, hundreds of thousands of people. And I think that was probably the best ending that he could have had.
Yes. And what were his justifications? I mean, was he very clear, or did they change?
No, he was very clear. He was very focused on causing chaos. He actually knew early on that if he wreaked havoc and made it very difficult for the U.S. to rebuild and actually fundamentally have consistent influence inside of Iraq, that would be our biggest challenge. And he ended up being fairly right.
And do you also see him fueled by basically anti-Shiite fervor?
I saw him fueled mainly by the same principles that Al-Qaeda has lived by, and he just extrapolated that to his own meaning. So he not necessarily anti-Shia. He was anti everything but someone who adhered to what his beliefs were.
Okay, so yeah, basically, you're not with my way of thinking, then you don't have the right to be on this planet. Mm-hmm. So, focusing on Zarqawi, and I guess you could say his legacy, today, Zarqawi's someone who's been called his successor, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a tiny bit about this person, and basically how he's taking over this role of a successor.
I think one of my biggest fears on the height that Zarqawi had reached was that someone's going to grab onto this and try to continue, carry this mantle forward and continue how he waged jihad. And, we're seeing the after effects of that today. I think largely through his successor. And I'm concerned that this is going to become some kind of norm throughout.
So that there's always another person that's more than happy to get in the former's shoes.
Exactly. I mean, we went from Al-Qaeda hitting government-focused targets to try to make a statement to random killing of innocent civilians. And it just keeps becoming more and more brutal as we go.
And then focusing on Iraq and Al-Qaeda, in March 2013, you have a Wired article from March 2013. And in that, you describe the relationship between Iraq and Al-Qaeda as two independent groups trying to exploit each other. Focusing on this, what are the tensions between a transitional movement like Al-Qaeda and a localized phenomenon like the Iraq insurgency?
So, you know, the run-up to the Iraq War, there was a different distinction between Zarqawi and the main core al-Qaeda group. Zarqawi was focused on a regional impact. He was focusing on the Jordanian government. He wasn't declaring jihad against the United States at the time. He was co-located in Kermal with Ansar al-Islam, where we had opportunity prior to the war to do something about him and his network. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there is a very distinct difference between someone fighting to have the governance that they believe in inside of their country versus someone who's waging jihad against another sovereign nation, you know, at any cost.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like there's more of a focus then on terrorists that have a wider view of who they're against? So like Al-Qaeda is a network and it's very anti-Western compared to Zarqawi, where at the starting, like you said, he was much more localized. So do you find that there's more of a focus on once they pass that localized line?
I mean, from the United States national security perspective, that's the natural line to draw. Your first concern is who is the largest threat to, you know, United States installations overseas and to the homeland. And those are your two big check boxes to start with.
And so when you have someone like Zarqawi that, say, his stage when he was localized, what happens? I mean, I know there's a lot of, you know, that they have the intelligence community in Jordan who's, I'm sure, interacting with U.S. intelligence and saying, hey, you know, this guy is up to this. And he's still a localized terrorist. What happens? Because, I mean, I'm sure that he's on the radar, but does he sort of get put to the side until you see that he develops into more of a broader terrorist with broader focuses, international focuses based on U.S. interests?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. At my time while I was there, that's exactly what happened. I mean, this is somebody that we need to be aware of. This is someone who shares a similar ideology, but is this an actual direct threat to the United States? At this time, we determined maybe this person is not. So therefore, you know, we treat that very differently. We would, you know, cooperate with the host government and, you know, share intelligence when we can. But, you know, for someone that is a direct threat to the United States, that's very different.
Right. And so basically someone that isn't at the moment sort of gets put on a shelf. They know about him, but he's been tagged almost. And then you go and focus on another, whoever's more, I guess you could say, dangerous at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we focus on women in the intelligence field, because I find this very interesting. I find it's a topic that is starting to get more interest. What was your experience as a woman working in the intelligence field?
You know, not unlike a lot of other industries. I mean, I came from several very male-dominated industries before I worked at the agency, but it depends on where within inside the CIA you work. If you're on the director of intelligence side where the traditional analysts are, that's, you know, as far as it's a pretty equal split as far as the population of gender. There's not, you know, more of one or the other. Everybody's doing a very similar job. There's not a sense of, well, because he's male, he's treated differently or vice versa. There is an element of that on the DO/NCS side. On the operational side, where traditionally it was men, and that's how that directorate grew up, was they were mostly male case officers. Well, that is not true today. There's many women who work as case officers and in other positions. But, you know, just like the rest of the culture of America, as goes the United States government, it's not any different than any other workplace in that sense.
And then I've heard you interviewed in different publications on questions of, as a woman, balancing work with family. And, of course, the intel community ends up having many after hours, much more intense hours than a regular job that could be 9 to 5 or a little bit later than 5, let's put it that way. But discuss this a bit, because I know that you're very much an advocate to show that women can have both if they're interested in being in the intelligence community. Let's hear your thoughts on that.
You know, I really feel like in many ways that the job within the agency was much more flexible, depending on the position you had, to be able to have a family and sort of curate the lifestyle you want. Now, can you still lean in and do the exact job you want to do and be out in the field? Well, it depends. Are you raising children? Do you want to be around, you know, as much with your kids, or, you know, it depends on what you really want out of your career. So, there is, I do believe, as far as deployment within the operations side, there's still a lot of work to be done to catch up to where women and families are today, because it does not support two people working when you're going overseas. It does not support being able to have both spouses gainfully employed. It's really difficult to do that in the way that it's structured.
Okay. There's something I continuously hear when it comes to women in the intelligence field, and that is the idea that women have a stronger intuitive skill than men. This is just something that I said, general thoughts that seem to come and pop up. Then they say men, on the other hand, tend to be more fact-based. So I would like to hear, in your personal experience and in your time as an analyst, how do you feel about this type of statement? And I mean, did you actually find yourself using more of your intuitive skills on projects and missions, but also, of course, adding factual basis, because I mean, facts are highly important, especially in the intelligence field. What are your thoughts on this?
So I would say, for the most part, people that are recruited as analysts and then people that are recruited as case officers, those are the two pointy end of the spear positions. There's a common thread that runs through each of the personalities of people that fill those types of positions, whether or not they're men or women. So I think first and foremost, that's key. And then secondly, I would say it's all individual based. I can't say that women, I don't know. I'm not a sociologist. Do women pay more attention to their intuition? I don't know. I mean, we seem to question ourselves certainly a lot more than men do. So maybe that's part of it. I don't know. I'd never, while working there, really thought about it from the perspective of how women approach it versus how men approach it. But I'm currently working on a draft of a book that's interviewing women who have been following Al-Qaeda since the 90s at the agency and their perspective. And I'm hoping through, you know, those interviews and writing this piece or the book, maybe some of that will become clear. Because I can't even say for myself what the difference would be between me and my male colleagues.
Right. I feel like in a situation where you're focused on finding information on a topic or a person, you'd be just so focused on that that you're not really thinking about how you're actually finding that information or getting it or how you're interpreting the information coming in other than just getting the job done.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Manhunt a bit, because it's very exciting. Of course, like we said at the starting, it just recently won an Emmy. How did your involvement come about in being part of the documentary?
I was just trying to figure that out the other day. I believe Peter Bergen, who I had met after I had left the agency, although I think he may have been aware of me before I left, but I'm not sure, introduced me to the director, and that's how I ended up getting involved.
And then, of course, the documentary features a number of other female analysts as well. Why don't we talk about some of them and the female analysts that you worked with? How was that working with them? What was the dynamics in the group that you were working in?
So the documentary gives this the appearance that we were all part of Alex Station. And Alex Station was just a piece of the analysts that were looking at Al-Qaeda. Not all of them were in. Like, Gina Bennett was not in Alex Station. Yeah. And I didn't join the agency until 2000, so I was not in Alex Station. But it did so happen the majority of the women majority of the counterterrorism analysts at the time were women. And, you know, and in talking to them and working with them even prior to 9/11, it was abundantly clear that there was just something about that, you know, topic that these women were dedicated to and sort of understood better than anybody else in the community.
And for those who have read Looming Towers, that book gives a very interesting look of how Alex Station was almost, at least at the beginning of Alex Station, that it was almost sort of the group of people that were sort of shoved in a corner, not really paid attention to that much. I mean, is that really the case? Or, I mean, because it really gives this idea that Alex Station was sort of shoved in the corner and really not.
Yeah, I mean, they were more of an informal group. I mean, they certainly, you know, it was not confronting a non-state actor wasn't something the United States government was that familiar with, and it wasn't something that they're spending a lot of time worrying about. So for someone to keep ringing that bell at the time, from what I understand, I think it was probably became dull for people listening to them. I think they just decided, but nothing's happening. You're saying the sky is falling, but we're not seeing it.
Right. And then focusing back on the documentary Manhunt, did they actually film in California, or did they come to you? How did that all work? Because I know a lot of people are not used to, I mean, it's not really Hollywood, but we'll say Hollywood as the film industry. Describe that a bit, because that's a whole different world for many people.
Yeah, that was a whole different world. I went down to California, to LA, and we, you know, filmed in a studio, and it was nerve-wracking to begin with. But I think, you know, I sat down with the director a couple different times for a couple different interviews, and the first time was probably a 4-hour conversation. And then the second time we were doing some of the computer work that you end up seeing on the documentary and whiteboard stuff. And so that was the second time. So there was a lot of technical filming stuff with that. Now that took a lot longer, but it was definitely something I am not used to doing.
And are you glad you did it? Was it a choice that you enjoyed being a part of it? I'm sure at first you'd probably have reservations a bit, just because it's new and unknown territory.
I had lots of reservations, probably for all the same reasons that Sheryl Sandberg wrote that book.
Right.
Because I kept thinking, but there's people who've done more than me. There's people who've been more involved than I have. And there's people who are at higher levels that are out. And why would I be in this film? And then I started thinking about it from the perspective and talking to some of the women that are still there and asking their take on it. And they just said, you know, and I started thinking, well, why not? Who else is going to tell it from a practitioner's perspective? Most of my friends are still there. And it's, you know, nothing to begrudge the senior level advisors who have left, who are mostly men, but they don't know how the work gets done, because they haven't, when they were younger analysts or case officers, it was done very differently. So it was something I thought that I could actually speak to and sort of help paint that picture of how difficult it was from the working level to deal with this issue.
And being a former analyst for the CIA, how do you look at the CIA now in our time, present time, let's put it that way? Do you see that the new analysts are continuing the legacy of the older analysts, or is the CIA, are the workings, how are they changing?
So the one huge praise I have for the agency is the way that they teach analysis and analysts how to become intelligence analysts within the CIA. They have institutionalized a practice that I think I've not seen any place else duplicated. So that in and of itself continues to live on. And those analysts that go through that type of training, you know, come out on the other end with the same direction and set of guidelines and everything that we all did, it's very consistent, which I think is fantastic. And they tweak it when they need to, and they develop other, you know, master classes as they need to. And I think they've done that part very, very well.
And how long does that program take to complete for a new analyst coming into the CIA?
You know, right now, I don't know how long it is. You know, it's been a while since I took it.
Right. In your own personal experience, how long did it take you?
this is a while ago. Let's see. Probably, I think it's at least in total, maybe 6 months. I can't remember.
Okay.
But there's a lot of, you know, once you're out, there's all sorts of stuff that you're asked to do to ramp up and become a full level analyst.
Okay. So going back to the war on terror, what do you see, or what do you think the future of the war on terror looks like at this point? Al-Qaeda has been, well, we hear reports that for a while it was brought down since bin Laden's death, but we're seeing a resurgence of Al-Qaeda and groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda, of course, having many different attacks around the world. So what does this war on terror look like to you?
Today?
Yeah, what is the future? I know this is a loaded question, but
hugely loaded today. Question. You know, my knee-jerk reaction would be, read Zawahiri's recent guideline speech. He's in it for the long haul, and there are many followers of Al-Qaeda who are in it for the long haul. And, you know, how effective they would be in, you know, marshaling plots against the United States is going to ebb and flow, mm-hmm. likely. And I think everyone has asked the question, well, how do we affect change? How do we actually get deprogram people to get out of these groups, these regional groups, this ideology? And I think we haven't effectively tapped into that yet. I think we're always fighting yesterday's war. So I think we need to start looking forward of what's the way out? Are we working with host governments to figure out how we help people get out of Al-Qaeda? How do they get out of the situation that they're currently in? Because once they're in, I think it's very difficult for some of these younger followers, if they've become disenchanted, to move on.
And then also, I mean, the speech recently that you mentioned, Zawahiri. Sorry, my mind went totally blank there for a minute. Especially recently, the September 11th, when he made this statement. I mean, he mentions Al-Qaeda sympathizers, and it really feels like potentially they still, you know, they don't have plans amped up as a group like they did on September 11th in 2001. I mean, do you feel like he's almost reaching out to what we'd consider lone wolves or smaller groups to do acts in the name of Al-Qaeda?
Yeah, I mean, I think he made that pretty clear with his statement that that's his expectation and that he's hoping to take some kind of credit for that going forward. But I also think that he's playing the similar role that he always has, where he's more of a guidance counselor than he is a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are part of AAP and you're looking at trying to develop, you know, guidelines for jihad, he wants you to use largely the text that he created and released. So I don't see effectively him really changing roles that much at this point.
Okay. Let's wrap up this conversation because it's been fantastic. We like to give our guests an opportunity basically to touch on something that potentially we might not have touched on in the conversation, or if there's something that's on your mind that you'd like to mention. So I'd like to bring that over to you.
You know, I think for the most part, what I find the most interesting in following sort of the public debate about what our national security should be, whether it's drones, the NSA and domestic surveillance, you know, how do we combat terrorism? What I find refreshing is that it's in the public domain and that we are starting to have these conversations. Because prior to 9/11, the public writ large wasn't really engaged with what the U.S. government was doing because it just wasn't a national platform. It wasn't something we were thinking about and thankfully weren't thinking about as much before 9/11. But going forward, I think it's great that at least there's some type of shape of narrative arc that the public can weigh in on. And I like the fact that it's being done through medium like this other than just, you know, major news outlets.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so, so much for coming on the show and your time on Manhunt actually was very, very informative, and I'm glad that you decided to join the production because you really added to the story. So thank you so much.
Thanks.
And we're going to post the link to Neda's blog, so please check that out, and we wish you a very good afternoon.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Bye.